If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today.
Welcome to Needle Exchange, conversations on the art of thread. Kaz Holmes is one of the UK's favourite textile artists, a respected teacher and author of numerous embroidered art books. Her work often uses found objects and has an alchemical philosophy where the creativity is discovered at the edge of uncertainty. Kaz and I have a terrific conversation about the fearlessness of surrendering to artistic flow, how to be resilient when life throws curveballs at you, and the value in paying attention to the everyday. You can find out more about Kaz via her website and get her books using the links in the show notes. If you enjoy the show, tell your fellow creators, and if you want to leave a review on your favourite podcast platform, that would be fantastic. Enjoy the show.
Yeah, let's start with that, because this is the interesting thing. I was trying to ascertain with you how deliberate your work is, given the fact that you like to... I'm almost like going in with my entire thesis straight away here. You use it as a form of documentary, but you also allow the objects that you find to dictate what you make. So it's not entirely, you're not entirely the director. It's like you're a co-director.
Absolutely. I like that. Yeah, I'm a co-director of the material. So there's something in the material that triggers me. The only true thing about the whole process is that none of the materials I use, you know, the base materials, even the threads, have been purchased. And most now in the last 20 years have been given. I haven't gone out and found them in charity shops either.
Right. Yeah.
Or collected on my travels. So that's really what I do. You know, I kind of retrieve these objects from hand to hand. And in the passing of them, I realise that I've come to identify that they have a history, and it's up to me to uncover that history. And often that history might be in partnership with the person who's given it to me. Unknowingly, they might have said, I've got a few old pieces of tablecloth, and I always wonder who did it belong to? So there's a mystery there. But there's also a commonality, because we all have these things somewhere hidden away.
Yeah. So I was thinking it's like you're a ghostwriter. You know, you get those situations where someone wants to write a book, but they're not that great at writing, so they employ somebody else to help them get it out of their system. Yours is obviously they're giving the work to you to make something with, but in a way it's almost like they're going, hi, can you interpret this for us? Or
No, I think that would mostly happen with commissions.
Right.
People give me materials. So I'm doing a personal commission and I'll ask them to maybe send me some information about what they were interested in or who the commission is for or what it's about. So I'd say that's more ghostwriting, but I'm still left to my own devices. So I don't know. Maybe I'm the devil writer.
This is a theme. She's a very respectable lady, Kaz Holmes.
Based on what I've been experiencing the last 2 years, there's somebody up there not doing me any good, but no. I kind of think it's a dialogue, because I think for me, all cloth, the minute you have it in your hand, I mean, you probably feel this even with newly purchased cloth, but your fingers are your, for me, my third eye.
Right.
In fact, I've only got one eye that's working. It's my second eye, basically.
Right, right.
You know, for most, you know, I always think that in the hands of a textile artist, the thing that differentiates me more from a painter is the amount of times my hand is on the cloth rather than distance from it, from a brush. And that feeling that the cloth gives as it passes through my hands, it's like uncovering it. You gradually uncover the story. So it's still my story to tell. It's more like a news reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. A soulful news reporter. I'm trying to uncover its story and what it means to me and where it has a connection to my experiences and what I'm going through. So I would say it's a meeting point. The cloth pushes what my own thoughts might be in various directions according to how I respond to it. And all of the fatalities that happen along the way with the bits of cloth, you know, things that don't go right. And I kind of engage with that as a part of the process.
It feels very brave. It feels like you must surrender a lot in the process because, you know, some people will go, I'm going to make this thing. This is the way it's going to look. And obviously there's always a bit of alchemy, whereas you're very much at the alchemical scale of things, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't have a clear... I call it a line of inquiry. I mean, my surname's Holmes. I kind of think about that idea as a line. Yeah, I often use that corny exchange when I'm teaching. But it's more like a line of inquiry rather than I am going to make. It's what am I interested in and how am I going to uncover that in what I make and what, and it kind of reveals itself in various stages as I'm processing that information. Even when work is on the wall, I have a piece I'm working on at the moment for Gypsy Maker project with the Romney Cultural and Arts Company, and they haven't seen it yet, but I'm reworking a piece that was important to me 10 years ago when I was at the knitting and stitching show because I identify with it in a different way. So I'll even rework my pieces. I've been known to burn pieces almost ceremonially. Rarely, no, it's just sheer frustration. I haven't got room in the loft and the bin is full. But, you know, I'm prepared to let go of pieces because it's like when they're in an exhibition, they're just resting in that space until I know what I'm doing with them next. So don't hold on to them too tightly.
And I think it's very... Yeah. And it's interesting that you're going back and revisiting old works again. Like, that's quite a thing to do. Like, I think a lot of people would go, oh, it's done, I'm moving on.
Yeah, but I've got hundreds, I mean, above my head there, I've got hundreds of sketchbooks. And I think we go through cycles of things and we draw upon past experiences in order to move forward if there is a thing. I mean, I'm very much in the basis that I'm having to live in the here and now, and I think make best use of each day. But where I am is in a very different place, and so sometimes when you uncover these, you know, things that are hidden in your house, that you've probably got many of them, Jamie, you know, they're hidden. You've got pieces that you've made that haven't sold, or you made them at that time and you've moved on, and somehow they start to kind of call back. They're calling back to me. You know, I'll be looking for something for an exhibition and undo it. And I thought, oh, that's the wrong package. Actually, that's quite interesting. I wonder. So I'm prepared. I cut them up and redo them and work into them and see what they tell me again.
Yeah. And you don't turn away from the work. Like, sometimes this isn't the same, right? But when I look back at early issues of my magazine, I cringe a little bit. And I wonder whether that's like an immaturity, because I'm not at peace with it, or I'm not willing to own it. You sound like you look back at your work with fondness and with a willingness to take it on board again.
Oh, I certainly have some cringy bits. I think we all do. I mean, art is built on failure, isn't that the old saying? It's not built on success, it's built on the failures. So there might be pieces I've never exhibited that I rework, but I kind of say to students occasionally when I'm working, you've got to love your ugly bits.
I think we all should do that as a method just in life.
Yeah, because we have this. I also think it's a railing against perfection. I think in the digital age, so much has become, you know, CAD design in the creative industries, and it's, you know, I'm not against anything to do with digital technology, but I want it to work at my level. So at this level, where we're able to communicate, because I can't be where I'd like to be now. I can't be out traveling, which is very important to me. That's where I used to pick the things up of the world that I worked with. You know, they would reflect the travels. But so I'm certainly not against technology, But I am for the handmade. And I think that using stitch and fan materials and honouring those fragments and fragile textiles of the past is incredibly important to me anyway. It's part of the process. They come with a history which a blank canvas doesn't come with. You have to imbue that with what you want to say if you've got a canvas. Where I have to have a dialogue, I've got no choice because it's there. Somebody's hands has already worked that piece of cloth.
Yeah, it's literally like you're time traveling with your fingers, kind of, aren't you? You know, there'll be be like residues and stuff, won't there? It's almost like you are touching people from the past in a sort of.
I've often used that. I think I used it in textile landscape. The idea I'm in a liminal place. I always feel I'm in between worlds. I mean, I trained in painting, so it's that hybrid status, which I don't like the word comfortable. Many people feel uncomfortable. They want to know certainty all the time where they are, where I thrive on that not knowing. It's when I get in a situation that's sometimes a little bit can be like that, the daily chores I now need to do with a caring responsibility. I have to find means to engage that side of uncertainty in myself in order to stimulate my creativity.
Yeah, I read, I like me old business books and all those sorts of things. And there's a guy called Seth Godin who did a book called The Icarus Deception. And the idea is that, you know, we get told that Icarus flew too far close to the sun and he failed, you know, but he's saying that's not what you should do. He said, if you're in that position where you feel anxious and nervous and tension and like your lizard brain is shouting at you, telling you you're going to fail, that's when you're the most alive because you're pushing at those boundaries. Now, it sounds like that's the same thing that you're kind of talking about, that uncertainty.
Yeah, and I kind of try to drive my students into that place on my courses as well, because it's only when you get to that stage that I believe you can move on with your work, because otherwise you're just doing what you already know. I try to do it in a supportive and safe environment, but to say it's okay to do that. It's okay not to know where the thing is going. Yeah. It's okay to... The questions you ask are really more important than the final outcome, because you need to find, I hate the word journey, but you need to travel that journey. You need to find that path. You need to excavate that your new way. You know, all of these terminologies I'm using are about discovery, aren't they?
Yeah, very much. Yeah, I mean, yeah. And you haven't used the word archaeology yet, but I feel there's a certain amount of that when you're unearthing things. Do you think the fact that you use found objects and things that people have given you is a shortcut towards uncertainty because you're already starting from an uncertain standpoint?
I think that's true. And we all think we know what textiles feel like because we wear them every day and, you know, we have an association with them. But that association can also be a connection to other people. But to then start to invest in that process of uncovering what that cloth is telling you, I think is valuable. Well, it certainly is for me. And but it also comes with that meeting point with the stuff I call the drawing stuff, the going out and observing the world as well. So there's always that element of that latent part of me that trained in painting and drawing and observation always comes into the work. So I suppose that I like the verb to draw as a verb as well. The fact that I'm drawing from several different points of view. So there again is that viewpoint. As I said earlier, I sit on the edge of textiles and painting. But also I'd say in my own background, because I have Romani heritage and working class, you know, I've got a degree. So there's that kind of liminal meeting point there. Keir Starmer was only talking about that this morning on the radio with regard to middle class kids not being able to get above a certain threshold. And I think I'm very fortunate to have been educated in the late 60s, early 70s, because, you know, I think a lot of middle class kids did get on and defy what was their normal path in life and went to art colleges.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. So you got a fine art degree in, is it 83?
Yeah, 83. College of Art. It's now University College of Arts.
And what brought you to that in the first place? What was young Kaz into?
Young Kaz was always outside or upstairs because I grew up in a pub. My dad was a painter and decorator.
Sign writer as well, right?
Absolutely. He was a sign writer. Mum would run the pub during the day and Dad would be out working. He worked with a small, you know, painting and decorating firm early on and later worked for, strangely enough, Jarrells and Son, which were book printers in Norwich. Yeah, that was his last job for the last 15 or 20 years of his life. And, you know, when I was 8 years old, we moved out of the pub. But certainly when you're young in the 60s, you couldn't be seen in the pub. So you were either outside. And and Dad said he'd never worried about me being bored because I'll always playing, doing, drawing or whatever I was doing. So I never forgot that need for invention, if you like, because being bored was part of life then. You weren't always filling every minute of your time with everything. You had to find things. But I found things to do. Naturally, just always have been inquisitive. And I went to school and started to draw. And I kind of remembered that I was doing some drawing of, it was an iris at the time. I must have been in a junior school. And the teachers had asked if I would do some drawing for some project or another. I think it might have been a little school catalogue in our little primary school. And I was working with the last stubby pens and things I had. These were the things Dad would buy me at birthdays and Christmases. You know, money was tight. So, you know, I'm not, you know, that's just how things were. And so they bought me a small art kit so I could do what I was doing and cleared it with Mum and Dad and said, she's doing a job for us. We wanted to do that. I don't think I'd be acceptable now, but I don't think I ever stopped wanting to draw. So it's really not a case of did I look out for it? I never stopped.
Right. And then when you went to college and you studied fine art, was textiles on the agenda at all?
No, I was on a drawing and painting course.
Right. So what brought the textiles into it?
Destroying a canvas I didn't like that I was compelled to work with as part of an art college project.
Right.
In our first year. And nobody in my, unknown to me, my mum knitted. I didn't find that out till later in life when she knitted me a cardigan. I'd never seen her pick up a needle in the entire time until I must have been in my 50s. And she gave me this cardigan. I said, that's lovely. Where did you get that? I knitted it. And I went, what? I'd never seen it. I won't talk anything else about Mum because it's another story, but it was just, I never ever saw my mother pick up a needle and thread, knit or do anything when I was a child or, you know, until 50, I was completely surprised.
Right. Yeah.
So nobody in my family, my grandmother kind of distanced herself from that stuff. You know, she tended to cook and look after the garden and, but I wasn't surrounded by textiles as a child, so I didn't have that. But I was surrounded by cartoons and things that Dad painted on our walls and his sign writing jobs and his love of looking, because he went to Norwich School of Art at 14. So he had an eye. He already had an eye. But, his career choices were very limited. So.
And would the sign writing have given you like an unconscious understanding of design?
I'd think so. I mean, I used to go and help him weekends when we worked for some of our older neighbours, which obviously I'm an older neighbour now, but we'd help them, you know, they'd get their materials and we'd volunteer and help put up wallpaper and that. And the ends I'd take home and work on because they were brilliant for drawing on. So again, that's that kind of...
Found objects.
So that kind of, you know, you could say it was embedded in me from early on, making use of what I had.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when you did your degree, like, so textiles wasn't a thing for you, but I'm interested to know whether textiles was even considered within the fine art.
We had Janice Jeffries as a course tutor, part-time course tutor.
Right.
So, and she'd also studied and researched with Magdalena Abakanowicz and the Polish weavers.
Right.
And when I first started to pull and work that together, that's when that another trigger alarm went off in my head and thought, oh, I find this much more interesting than just working on the surface, because it was a damn, well, the person who painted it probably thought it was lovely, but it was a painting left over from the previous student cohort, and that, you know, that it was just a project reusing what other people had left and doing something with it. And I just found it much more engaging, and that really got me investigating what materials could do. But a limited range, you know, early on I studied mostly paper and paper making, so for the first 15 to 20 years, most of my textile exploration were on mostly paper substrates.
Right. And machine embroidery, has that has been a thing since the start?
Probably towards the end and after I graduated. A lot of it was layered papers and hand stitch. Again, it was to do with what was accessible to me at the time and discovery. And also my involvement with being invited to do work with people like the Embroiderers Guild, etc. I began to be exposed to a different way of working. And I just took what I wanted from that exchange by people wanting to learn from me. I also, as a tutor, always learn from the students as well. But I always worked with a mechanical sewing machine. My very first was a Pfister and Rossmann. My second, which is still sitting beside me today, was an old vintage Bernina 730, which I found in a skip at an art college I was working at the time, and begged to take it home with me. And they said, yes, if you can repair it, you can have it. Which
like
I did.
King Arthur pulling a sword out of a stone. Gaz pulls a Bernina out of a skip.
Yeah. Well, it makes that mechanical drawing mark, but it's more than that. I do it with a... I mean, I love hand and machine stitch combined. It's strange. I'm often asked, do I hand or machine, by many people? And I do both because they're like different types of mark. And I make them because of the mark they make, as much as I'll make a mark with a paintbrush or, you know, there's gold paint on the piece behind me. Actually, it's not gold paint. It's foil from cigarette packets.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Again, there we go. It's sort of it's been a lifelong love-hate relationship.
Do you have what? I mean, so this process has been going on a long time. I mean, have you been solely an artist? You're an artist and a teacher
and a writer
and a writer, of course, and a writer,
an author.
I mean, but how many books have you got under your belt now?
5.
Yeah, they're good. I like them. I like the embroidery in the Everyday, the latest one.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I call it my lockdown book, but they're all, for different reasons, tough to write. That was written in double quick time, but I was given the opportunity to extend that. They wanted it. Batsford are fabulous to work with. So, and our voices are left within the writing. But it was hard to write for various reasons.
Can you go into those reasons?
Well, we were, I suppose, we were all in lockdown, so that ability to engage and meet with the artists had shifted. And I knew that some of the things I was discovering about myself as part of the process of not being in that space, which is valuable to me, you know, and it's still valuable to me. I mean, I have been teaching via Zoom by invitation. I have done some courses with West Dean, which they've been very supportive in encouraging me to do some Zoom courses with them. But I do them for invitation because, as you know, my partner had a stroke, so I need to balance that time between care. I call it the care, clean, and create balance now. But that almost is like that was the full stop on the end of the pandemic. So during the pandemic, and we're still in it, you know, we're still facing that, you know, people are still getting sick. That for me not to be in the world was really tough. And I know it was tough for everybody. I'm not making any illusion. And I thought, well, if I thrived on the fact that I could come back to this house, but I could go out in the world. And I certainly did go out in the world. You know, it's my Romany. I think my Romany roots, I just ply my trade in a different way to my grandparents' family. I'd already had seeds for a book Batsford had said, what would I be interested in doing next? And I already had the seeds, but I said I was going to take time off. I wasn't going to write for a few years. I wanted to focus on my work. But then the pandemic hit, and it kind of discussions came between us, and I said, would you be prepared to do something? And that's really how the book evolved. But for that reason, it kind of came out of that, again, out of uncertainty, mm-hmm. which is where I thrive. Maybe Batsford recognised that within my work, that I best write. You know, even when I write, I don't have the whole book planned out.
Right.
I have the content of what I think I want to say in it, but I'm willing to shift and change, rather like with my work. As I write, I leave space for that. So 75% through the book is when I really begin to see how it really finally forms. But I allow flexibility because you never know what's around the corner. I do know that there's something that's driving inside of me when I write, in the same way with my work, that kind of, say, a core, like a dancer has a core. I think all artists have that, their own core. And you mm-hmm. you should allow yourself to kind of go in different directions. But somehow being able to voice my thoughts and engage, being very fortunate that artists have been involved with that writing as well, is a privilege. Mm-hmm. And I don't take it lightly. I think it's incredibly important that I engage with other artists as part of the process of writing so that people can see that we all respond to our tribes, if you like. That we all need a family that we belong to when we're creative. And these can stimulate and develop ideas.
Yeah, I think actually that's a really important point, isn't it? Because it's quite easy to feel like you're creating in isolation just naturally, particularly because it's not a team sport, is it, the stuff we do? It's like individual work. So it's quite easy to feel like you're the only person there, whereas actually there is a community. You just have to reach out and touch them. They're not kind of as far away as you feel.
Yeah, and I think that community is very supportive and presents their own challenges. I mean, I've certainly known that within the last year. So literally the day the book was published, Derek had his stroke. So I couldn't go out and, you know, it's like, again, that liminal place. It's one part of me wanted to celebrate and the other part of me was just running around thinking, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, can't imagine. Go on.
Yeah, extreme emotions on that day.
Yeah.
For various reasons.
One of the things I appreciated about the book, it felt sort of quite zen in as much as, you know, it's called Embroidering the Everyday. And to me, it's about paying attention to the small stuff, stopping and smelling the roses, and just reinforcing that point, because I think that there's beauty to be found in the quiet moments. I see a lot of artists who do that. You know, they capture vignettes, they capture moments, and there's that documentary style of art that means that people capture the magic we might not realize is magic, but they do. And then that gives it some value.
Yeah. And somehow I think even when I've traveled, I made a comment when I was in Australia, because I make quick sketches when I was in Australia, but I never really made any specific work about that experience of being in Australia. And I'm fortunate to have been there 5 or 6 times. And then one piece came out of it called The Edges of Australia. But it's also, again, was to do with the commonality, because I need to be of a place to be able to make something reflecting that. You know, I need to know where I fit in, and so Australia will always feel alien to me, but there were commonalities, and that was what that piece was about, the edges where we touch each other, like the washing lines or people having plants that were definitely I'd recognize in my own garden, particularly in Melbourne area and Victoria, those commonalities but were slightly different. So it's where I saw the everyday things that I was familiar with, but in a different context that throws me. So, again, in the Netherlands, I can find a connection. So I grew up in Norfolk. So there's a lot of similarities in the approaches. But I need to be of a place. So even when I'm traveling, I don't try and fly, you know, once I'm working in a place, I tend not to want to be going at 10 miles, at 100 miles an hour and looking at things. I'm quite happy to spend days in one place just so I become more familiar with it and get to know the feel of the place real sense of the place as opposed to just an awareness.
Yeah, you can understand why people are happy to find a McDonald's, because it's a place that they know is going to be the same, and it's almost like you're standing on a steady rock in a river, and now that you're on a steady rock, you can go, okay, now I can have a look around the river, because like it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs or something, isn't it? My structure, my foundation's there.
Yeah, maybe I'm looking for the familiar and unfamiliar places.
Yeah. So that then when you're in the familiar, you're at peace to then face the uncertainty.
Yeah. But, and I would say that's what this house does for me. I mean, I don't know if you've ever done that or had that experience. There are times, you know, when I was out in the world that I wanted to then come home. I was desperate to come home.
Mm-hmm.
And not due to anything that my hosts or anything. You get to a point where you just want to be back and doing things that weren't with other people for a while, and vice versa. In some respects, that's, I'm having to drive and find different ways to seek that engagement today, which is what I'm doing. I'm kind of accepting of what life throws at me. I've always been. I'm flexible in that way. Doesn't mean I don't get angry at times, but I just think, well, that's my life. How do I handle what I have now?
I mean, that's what you've said all along, is the your capacity to manage the uncertainty and to process it. So we go through fear, don't we? And we go through joy, but you don't want to let those things overwhelm you. You don't want to stop them getting in the way of progress. And that's kind of what you're saying there.
Yeah, and also it's about harnessing it. I've learned an awful lot in the last 2 years. I wouldn't say I deliberately go out and seek it as seek adversity or challenge as a place to learn, but learning comes out of it, whether you want, for me it does anyway, whether you want to or not. So I engaged with it, finding out what are things naturally, as the things start to settle here, I began to become more aware of how important vision is, how important our sense of space is, both physically and mentally, through needing to work with physio, with my partner. But also it raised other sets of questions in my head about how we all look at the world. And I think embroidering the everyday kind of set that seed to begin with. Because it was a shift to, I think for most of us, it was a huge shift in how we could be and how we could look at the world.
Yeah. I got quite lucky because we moved house literally a week before lockdown. So the new place we moved to, we didn't know what we were missing. And in a way, that was an interesting buffer, because we weren't missing out, because this was all new. So the fact that it was very quiet and the only person, my best friends were Mr. and Mrs. Hermes, the people that delivered packages. It was kind of like, was all like fine, you know, didn't really have to work on that. So traveling then has been integral to you. And obviously you've said about Australia. You've also been to India a few times?
Yeah, a couple of times I've been to India, and I was due to be in India in the last, you know, I look at the calendar and think of all of the things I'm continuing to cross off. You know, we all crossed off things during the pandemic, and I was beginning to book things in just as, you know, we had a stroke. And there was a time where I thought I could start going out more into traveling. That's what you're told, that things will go back to sort of normal once you've got a care package in place. Well, that is totally unrealistic. I've accepted that. But I do work. I've gone to do some workshops in schools locally. I mean, locally, I mean in Kent. I'm going to doing some training. Yeah. I'm teaching. My only live course this year is at West Dean in September. Derek's brother is coming over, flying over. So he has time with Derek, so I can do that, because it is important to me to be out in the world and doing something where I'm physically in the same place with people and teaching now and again. I try to do that at least once a month, whether it's local or with a group. But I think my ability at the moment to be able to go on long engagement trips of exhibitions, etc., is virtually impossible.
Yeah.
I managed to get to the Antwerp last year for the launch of the shipping forecast.
Right.
And again, that was due to a family member flying over, Derek's family member. My own family live in Norfolk, and I can't go into various reasons why, but they're facing their own difficulties, which means it's very hard for them to come down for a few days. But you know, that was so important. So if there's something really important, that is a viable option, but I can't depend on it.
Yeah. When you've done your traveling, because you said that, you know, people have been giving you items and various things. I'm guessing when you go on your travels, you pick up a few bits and pieces here and there. I'm just wondering if there's a way, like, say, a visit to India, whether that visit in itself becomes like a found object that then you end up processing.
The the experience does. I mean, I'll give you an example of how two different cultural situations. India will be a good one to start with, and I'll go back to Antwerp. But in India a few years ago, I was invited to do a project with a school, a girls' school, and I went for over for about 4 weeks. Some of it was funded by the Arts Council and the British Council to do this exchange. So I would be picking things up from the street, etc. But part of it was also research into my own cultural background, because the Romani gypsies originally came from Northwest India. So I was looking for the familiarity that I could see in the way that my grandmother had things in her house, and the images and photographs I had of her family in the vados, the caravans, with the paintings and the style of painting that I chose to use weren't very different to some of the paintings on the walls and on the textiles in Northwest India. So they kind of brought home the idea that we have far more in common with each other, as people, than we have as differences. You know, there'll be subtle differences, but we can trace our roots. And in fact, the Romani language has its roots in the Indian language. So there is that connection. So I made pieces around that time. This was 20 odd years ago, and that went on tour called Traces. So there was that dialogue about the past, the connection I have with my family, and what I uncovered about it. So we come to today, and I don't know if you've seen anything. I can give you a link at the end of this project, the shipping forecast.
Right.
They're all fragments of cloth. Some of them I picked up at Folkestone and Dover, but many were given to me as I travelled to do work in Europe mostly, but I've got some from some from Australia and some from the USA. But I really made a point of just having these torn and distressed fragments that I hand-stitched words that I'd picked up or headlines in the newspaper about migrants, my and where they're going to, where they're coming from, both positive and negative, but the whole issue of people moving around. And wasn't certain why I was doing it. I just started to stitch these words. And when I went over to Antwerp, I lost a whole portfolio of work. I was having an interview for a major project, which was going to be and was exhibited at at the church in the centre of Antwerp, city of Antwerp, which obviously is where the Cunard lines came from. Where the migrants went from Antwerp, from Liverpool, from Ireland to the USA. So I'd visited the museum, I stayed with friends, worked with the church, but I had this interview, but I'd lost the whole portfolio I was taken with, never got it returned. So I'd lost a whole body of work, including these samples, apart from the one I had in my hand. So the only thing I had for this interview was this fragment of cloth with these stitched words in. I contacted them on my way in. I think it was actually just, I'm not going to go into detail, but it just seemed to me, on reflection, many people who travel lose so much of value to them. They lose their family. They can only put things in a small bag to carry. They lose their connection to place. Nobody would be migrating or moving or getting on those boats if they weren't in real trouble in the first place. Yeah. You and I wouldn't make that choice to get on a boat in the middle of the sea like that. So that I'm not saying it was an easy body of work and I have any answers, but I wanted to use it to raise questions in myself and just see what happened, or that kind of nurturing thing that you have with cloth about saying we can still care, even if we're asking questions. And some of the words I stitched were uncomfortable for people to see.
Yeah.
So I explained what I wanted to do, and they had some images, and I thought, there's no way, because he had lost the portfolio. I had nothing to show them. And I actually got the exhibition.
Right. Yeah.
And that for me was the power of a piece and fragment of cloth to communicate. Remember I said at the beginning how it can communicate? Mm. It may well be that it's also my ability to communicate. I kind of speak from here. I'm not an academic communicator. Mm. I trained in community arts, so I often things will come out of my mouth before I've thought about them, and they'll be completely upset people. But I just think we have to be honest in our communications.
Now go on.
Yeah, so I came back. When I came back from that meeting, I stayed with one of the hosts, and I came back with some fragments of cloth they wanted to give to me. They said, you know, they couldn't. I mean, I was panicked when I lost the portfolio, I wasn't kind of tearing my hair out. Somehow it kind of, after I'd had that initial panic and things settled, I said, well, you just got to move on from that. There's nothing. It could turn up, it couldn't turn up, because it's done. Because they had this artist invited every year to fill this church, and I filled the basement. I mean, shipping forecast, people can find a link to it on my
page. Yeah, I'll put a link in the chat.
So you had these fragments, or my small samples and some of my work pieces, so they could see how I worked in more detail, completely lost. And when we had the meeting, I was actually talking about how we could engage with that community around them. And they have something called the forensic sciences, which isn't the same as us for working with people who had mental health problems. So it's their way of working. We had people working and engaged locally to the church, as well as some needlework groups, and they produced work to go in this exhibition, because I said I wanted it to be about an engagement with people, because the whole thing was about that interrelationship of working with people and talk and using fragments that reflected that migrant story. But I also had pieces from all over the world, because I'd invited people, because we're in pandemic, I'd invited people to send in a fragment of cloth with something stitched onto it, which was about what they valued and what they missed. And that whole concept of something you valued and missed actually came from a project I did with the Romani Cultural and Arts Company 3 months before the pandemic hit, when I was still talking about migrants. You know, that idea that what would you value enough to put into your rucksack if you had to move from your place of safe, from your home, and what would you miss that you couldn't pack, that you left behind, like the roses or your grand, you know, all of those things. And that really started with the young man at our adult education centre who was coming to Esau Clark classes, and I sat down and chatted with him, because he was waiting and was obviously upset. And I found out a little bit about his story, and what he missed was his grandmother's rose garden. So you know, cloth has this means to touch people. And I felt there is something here that also reflects my story. You know, I've been quite open about being Romani in the last 15, 20 years of Romani heritage, put it that way. But I may not have been as a child, because it's a tough thing to admit to being in education. You know, it's still not easy. Strangely enough, I think within the lockdown, those words still had significance. What did we miss about not being able to go out, meet with friends, and doing our normal daily things? Yeah. And what did we value more because we were staying put? What were we aware of more? Because people always, you know, they're looking forward to their holiday away, aren't they, each year?
Yeah, I always thought it fascinating that there was that handmade resurgence. You know, people weren't able to casually consume things, but this innate desire for stuff meant that people sort of started to realise they could make their own things again.
Absolutely, and there was a lot of engagement. I mean, I was very proud of the creative industries during that time, who just really got out there and did things voluntarily, just to. I would say it's about the well-being. People, well-being isn't just about keeping fit. It's about engagement with your for me, it's about intellectual challenge, creative challenge, and physical challenge. you know, look, that's what your well-being is all about, as far as I'm concerned. The heart of mind is the creative challenge, but the intellectual challenge comes from these sort of discussions, and we all need that.
Yeah. I always remember The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, which when I first heard about it, I thought was The Habits of 7 Highly Effective People. And I was like, I wonder who those guys are. But as an aside, the last habit is always sharpening the saw. And I think that's an interesting one. You know, if you're a successful woodcutter and you want to keep cutting wood, you've got to keep sharpening your saw. You've got to make sure that your tools you use are in good condition. And I think that's what that is, isn't it? It's just.
Yeah. And I mean, when you said earlier on about working with that uncertainty, I think that's part of that process. If you've, you know, how far can you push it? It's when a piece of work when I start to think, God, I don't know where it's going, or I'm a bit scared by it, or it's raising questions I don't know, or I'm not certain, that's when I get more excited about it. And sometimes want to throw it at the wall, but that wouldn't do much damage. It's a piece of cloth, but, you know, it'd be lovely if it's, I was making a ceramic, I'd make a lovely resounding smack against the wall.
I was going to say, considering you said that one of the first things that got you going was you knocked some paint onto a piece of fabric, like throwing something at a wall, I'd imagine is just part of your process as standard these days, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the other thing I note is that you spend a lot of time looking for questions rather than answers.
Yeah, I don't know why. That's that little girl in the garden at the pub all over again. You know, I remember with my granddad and sometimes with dad, because I'd always, when dad worked at Jarrell's, instead I'd stay on at school because it was a quiet place for me to continue with my homework rather than home. And then I'd walk down to Jarrell's and we'd often walk home together. Yeah, I had a lovely relationship with my dad. But I always remember from very early on, I'd ask questions, but he always got us to look up at buildings and look around and ask questions. So I think that's been my life. I don't know why. Maybe I'm just an annoying person who just always asks questions because that's how I am. You know, I never accept that there is one answer because it depends on your viewpoint. I mean, some things it might be is 2 and 2, 4, for example. But there's always another viewpoint. And I think that's being engaged as a community artist and as involved with teaching has been has given me a great deal of experience. Of that need to ask questions rather than to always accept the answers you're given. You know, I listen to the news and think, maybe there's another way. Yeah. Not always certain I know the way, but I'm always questioning.
I think a similar analogy, I was part of Milton Keynes Embroiderers Guild when I lived in Milton Keynes, and it was great for me because I got exposed to textile art that I wouldn't have sought to find. So, you know, what is it? Confirmation bias, when we often just look for stuff that we already agree with. I think we owe it to ourselves to do the opposite of that and go and get people to explain stuff that we haven't got the foggiest, because it makes us a broader human being, I guess.
Yeah. And I've always retained my interest in other art forms as well. So when I'm working on courses, I don't look at textile artists purely. You know, I teach drawing and painting at adult education, so I'm constantly exposed to that's that side of my training, if you like. So I'm constantly exposed to that. And I've been involved more recently in supporting the We Care project. I can probably have details at a later date. In fact, I sent a parcel today from the project, but it's in support of carers, but it's self-supporting because there isn't a lot of, and they're engaging in a craftivists campaign, and are working alongside domestic dusters.
Right. Yeah, I know of domestic
dusters. With Vanessa Marr. I think that craftivism is in a way of asking questions and challenging authority through craft, isn't it?
So, Sarah always says that it's a way for people to challenge things comfortably. It's like soft protest, that kind of thing, rather than like placards.
Yeah, and sometimes it can be more effective because it creeps up on people because they realise what's happened. You know, Katie from The We Care, I hope she doesn't mind me re-quoting her. Sorry, Katie. Said that at one event, I think in Wales, people were hand-stitching. And the MP that had come to the event, so I'm not kind of saying what the event was, who the MP, so I'm not going to reveal any of that, because even if I remembered the names. When she was aware of what was being stitched onto the pieces of cloth, it hit her. She realised that voice came through much more profoundly than just a protest. She thought she was going to a little craft event where people be knitting. But then it kind of reached her here in her heart. Yeah. And I think that is the underlying power of the needle and thread. And suffragettes knew that. Suffragists knew that. Grenham Common knew that. You know, whether they consciously knew, but textiles and protest have always been together in some form or another. That soft protest.
Yeah, yeah. It's a curious one, isn't it? Because it does. I've had the same experience doing a project once with an MP who I won't name, but I always like to joke and say, you know, I could see his frozen cold heart start to melt ever so slightly, thanks to the power of textiles.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've done quite a lot of exhibiting yourself, and then recently you've been in this joint exhibition with Rosie James.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, it was Batsford has got a gallery, and they asked if I would exhibit. Normally it's for a week, and I like Rosie. She doesn't live very far from me, and our work is quite different. But I think I could see possibilities. So I contacted Rosie, and the thing is, it was practical as much as it was the fact I like Rosie. It was the fact that if you had two people, you had 2 weeks, and because of my current situation, I couldn't justify going up there one day to hang and go. I didn't have 2 days in a week that I could go up and hang and take down. So it stretched the exhibition out. In fact, we had nearly 3. Mm. And we trundled over there with our trolleys. And the exhibition came out of my shopping trolley and Rosie's backpack. So this huge space was filled with the shipping forecast and her crowd cloud. And the reason it came about was I felt that we were speaking about the movement of people. Mm-hmm. And that have those two together. Because when I talk about the shipping forecast, which is this piece that has a word stitched on and faces my family, symbolic of migrant people, I didn't feel I had the right of taking photographs and putting those photographs on the cloth of people I didn't know. So it became symbolic of those people. And Rosie's beautiful line drawings of the crowds coming out of London Bridge Station. They're moving with purpose, one to work, migrating every day to work, if you like, backwards and forwards on the train, and mine reflecting people moving across continents for necessity.
Yeah.
And often they could pass each other in the street. And I know from working with a homeless charity and sometimes our own reaction that you can walk past and not see people.
Mm.
You know, we choose, and we thought it would be an interesting juxtaposition. And I was really, we were gradually, when we were hanging the exhibition, that's what I love about the textiles, is that we put one piece up, then another, and they start to have a dialogue. They were talking to each other. So they were we were keen that they were interspaced with each other in that space. You could see through some of Rosie's sheer fabric to my semi-sheer pieces where the light came through. So I always think that when I exhibit, when I engage with artists as respected as Rosie, that we share that space. We had chats about what worked and what didn't work. That's pretty normal, but a good friend and colleague able to do that. But it really worked well. We were pleased to hang this exhibition there, but also what it does for me by seeing my work in different spaces, especially whether it's on the wall or in a different venue, because it went from a church basement that looked like I felt had the feeling of the workings of the basement of a big liner, all the pipes in the basement where that originally was shown, to a gallery in Ireland where it had a huge window, so the light was coming through, that when textiles hang in a place, they have this ability, though the core of what they're saying is still there, to interrelate with that space, like they interrelate with us when we wear them. So my cardigan would look completely different on somebody else. And I think that's, for me, a positive added value of textiles in a gallery space, is that they actually interact with that environment in the way that they have historically always interacted with us, whether they're in our homes or on our bodies.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, then the interactivity is a thing, isn't it? That speaks to what you were saying about being able to touch it before. I was thinking about, I did the Stitch Your Story installation, which we had in Blackburn Cathedral.
That was fabulous. Funny thing,
yeah. And it was, thank you. It was just the thing that was interesting is the church, the cathedral itself, you wouldn't think would do much, but it just like the subtle air movement, just in this vast space, was enough to always keep these little dangly things just twisting and turning, you know, and it just kept the whole thing alive.
Well, I had an installation called Trees, which I was part of the Art Textiles. I belong to a group called Art Textiles Made in Britain. And just a little push here, we're exhibiting at the Knitting and Stitching Show this year.
Yep. Awesome.
So I'll have some pieces. Our title is Illuminate, and I'll have some pieces there reflecting the theme Glimmer. When you're working, I'm going off my train of thought now. This is normal. This is Kara's brain. I'm sorry about that, Jamie. This is Kara's brain. Yeah. So when I had this former piece, Trees, in exhibition, it was originally the Knitting and Stitching Show, but it went to this cathedral. That was in the upper part of the cathedral. So I had shipping forecast in the basement and several signature pieces in the church itself. Sorry, not a cathedral. It felt like a cathedral. It's a modern building, beautiful, beautiful modern building with stained glass. So they were hanging there and they were not far from the organ. So people would move around and it would move. But when the organ played, they just spun around gently and moved like trees would. It was lovely. That's what I meant, that the cloth, because it's not held tightly to a frame, has this possibility of movement. And that's what I like, you know. A couple of times in my career when I've made commissions, people say, well, wouldn't it look tidier if you stretched it on a frame? And I thought, I don't want it to be tidy. I want it to reach out. You know, so we've got this thing about, you know, you need to remove yourself from the tyranny of those edges. It needs to interact.
Yeah, yeah. And then I was interested because, you know, when you exhibit by yourself, it's one thing. When you exhibit as part of a big group, there's a lot of compromises you make. But then it's interesting when you just exhibit with one other person, like you say, and there's a dialogue and there's like a relationship that unfolds. So it was really interesting to hear you speak to that.
Yeah, yeah. And that was kind of a lot. I would say it was quite a quick decision. It hadn't been something we'd planned. And I know Rosie's Crowd Cloud hadn't been seen for some time, but we immediately, when we got into the space, I knew I was going to put the shipping forecast, and I didn't know what she wanted to exhibit, and she just said, I'd like to put Crowd Cloud with it, and that's just how it went. We had a few other pieces that kind of related to the theme of travel and migration, so that was really relevant, but it was really lovely to see our work together. And I'm going to try to seize as many opportunities like that as I can. You know, the fact that I have been able to exhibit in the last 2 years has been down to my partners. I mean, I've got an exhibit. This shipping forecast goes up to Scotland in August on the invitation of Craft Scotland. And we're doing everything via Zoom. And I had thought that I would be able to go up to see it, but that's not going to happen. For various reasons, and not least of all because trying to get anywhere in the summer when people are on holiday, so there's a shortage of carers, so that means I can't get enough cover to even manage a few days off, you know, and I can't rely on that, but I accept it. I mean, I exhibited in Ireland, the exhibition was planned before Derek had his stroke, and Rob, who runs the gallery, put the work up with his team. We were via Zoom. I did a meet the artist via Zoom to a whole gallery of people. So, you know, that's one thing the pandemic has taught me. I don't know if I'd have been able to have done it before the pandemic, having this interaction. It has its value, Jamie. It's, you know, when your choices become limited, you make the best choice you can that suits you, suits the situation you're in. That's how I see it. And I've been very fortunate in my life that I've worked with a lot of people over the years, and my project partners, the people I've worked with over the years, have actually been very supportive of me over this period of time.
No, that's amazing. I was going to ask you, I was going to ask you about the change with Derek and how, whether you can feel that pulling your creativity in a different direction.
I would say 100% yes.
Yeah. Is it too early to say what that is? Are you in the exploring the uncertainty phase?
I'm kind of moving through that. I think for me, it was like I did a piece because I was, it was very unusual for me to be here at home on my own. That's never happened. So you can imagine he's in hospital for 11 weeks. He's the person who's the homebody, and I'm the person out traveling in the world. So I'm in this house. Apart from, we were still in the pandemic, so I could only go and see him for an hour every 3 or 4 days. So, So I'm in this house on my own. I kept up a couple of engagements, but some of it I couldn't anyway because of needing to be around at the hospital. And so it became a place where I had to work through a lot. And what I did was turn to the needle again and to my sketchbook. And it was the middle of late summer, early autumn, the lot to be done in the garden. So the watcher in the garden had to become a gardener. And during the quiet times, I'd sit and stitch the things I discovered in the garden I hadn't paid attention to. So again, it's that paying attention to the overlooked, because that was his domain. He loves and still loves gardening. He gets out and waters when he can. But I do the heavy work, but simple things. And I think that's what I started to do, much the same I did with the shipping forecast for a very different reason. Well, his first words were when I was talking, I couldn't find a WD-40 because a lock had jammed in the gate, and I needed to get the gate between my neighbour and myself open. They've been incredibly supportive, but I couldn't get the lock undone. And you go and you visit someone for an hour, and at the first week or so he was not communicating at all, you know. You just talk. Mm. And I just said, you know, I still can't find a W, and he suddenly replied, it's in the cupboard above the toilet where it's always kept. And I thought, Derek's still there.
Amazing.
So his communication was there. What he has, this is why I've been playing around with things to do with how the brain works. He has the visual version of aphasia. So he's a maker, he's a sculptor, he built a lot of the things in this house. Mm-hmm. So his eyes function perfectly, but his brain doesn't pick up the signals.
Right, okay. Yeah. Interesting. Right.
Yeah. So he's improving, but we're aging as part of our lives. There are things that are happening to me, you know, I still cycle, I still walk. But it takes me longer to do things. I have to consider things more. You know, you'll find it happens to you, Jamie.
Oh, God. I'm starting to see a need for yoga already. You know, I'm there. I'm creepy.
I don't know if I've ever got that far yet. But, you know, I do. It's not, you know, trying to get out to do that is harder for me. Even doing that is harder for me now.
Yeah.
You know, I go out for 2 or 3 hours and I have an app on my phone. If I'm going for a walk, I can check he's okay.
So
it's those sort of things. So I have 3 hours respite where I don't have to even look at the app. Somebody comes in and I get that. And I'm learning to trust that I can go out for a couple of hours or have someone coming in for an hour, and if things happen, they happen. It's not easy, but they're going to happen if I'm here or not. So it was about me trying to understand how I also needed to slow down for him, because he needs to go at a slower pace. So I needed to slow down in order to work, particularly the first year, and then when he broke his hip again, but needing to work at his level, work with his physio on his therapy, although not all the time. He didn't want me to be doing that because the physios were trained and I'm just Cass, so I had to, you know, but you know, it's been a revelation. The fact he's up walking with a quad stick, not far, but he's walking is to me a small miracle.
Yeah, definitely.
And
definitely.
Of his determination.
Yeah. And it's nice that you've been able to keep your creativity going as well, though. You know, for a lot of people, I think it might just knock things, you know, completely on hold. But it's good that you've been able to maintain the flow, even if it's a diminished, slower flow.
Yeah, I think I was determined to do that. I don't know why. Maybe it's that madness in me. But I felt if I don't keep that part of me going, what good am I going to be here? I have to do something for myself. It's harder. I admit it's a lot harder. But I need to have something that engages my brain differently to the care role, because otherwise I can't do the care role.
Yeah. And maybe one thing helps, the other thing helps, the other thing kind of, yeah.
And I don't think it's good for him either. I think he'd, you know, I don't know. I've had the conversations sometimes, but it's also often with friends. It must be hard for him to see that the effect that's had it does affect both of us.
Yeah. Yeah, it adds an extra layer, doesn't it? Of, you know, you can feel guilty enough when you're immobilized, can't you? I broke my ankle once. It's that same thing. But when it starts to have a wider impact, it just gives you extra layers of guilt if you want to, doesn't it?
But at the same time, I've also recognized, you know, although that is tough, I have to put this across clearly. I've used it as a learning experience, and that's fed into my work.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would have fed into my work because that's the way I work normally. It's, as you said right at the beginning, I use the narratives within the cloth that I found to tell stories.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter to me whether the person who sees my work gets my story. When it's out in the public domain, it's what stories they take away from it, what they have. And maybe this need to tell stories is embedded in the roots of my history, because the Romani culture has always been about the narrative history, spoken history.
Mm. Yeah, because those are the things you can take with you, aren't they?
They are the things you can take with you. And the familiarity again coming through. So what's happening to me is my experience, but what we're going through isn't unique to me only.
Yeah.
I know that. So yeah. As an artist, I want to use what I feel and know. I've always done that in my work because that's my voice, and I'm not going to be quiet about what's happening.
Because, no.
You know, that, and I really don't, it sounds awful. I care that people have their own voice and they can come and engage with work. But what they think about my work no longer matters to me anymore. I do what I want because I want to do it.
But you have the faith that people can use your work as a tool for their own understanding, because that is also something you've mentioned before. You know, they can triangulate their positions by looking at what you're saying.
Yeah. And also within working with alongside them, I tend not to think about workshops when I'm teaching. I say workshops. I think it's about trying to share what it is to be creative is more important to me than this materials we're working with and what we do with them. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's about sharing that this is what that creativity is about. And I can't teach anyone to be creative. Nobody can do that. But through engaging with them in a workshop, in a place of work where workshops can happen, and using the tools of teaching and engaging and making, I can open up those possibilities for them to engage with their own creativity. And that's really fundamentally important to me, that through learning a technique, you might go beyond that technique and ask and not want to know how to do something, but the why to do something is more important. Why are you doing it? What's it for? So I think in textile landscape, I close with that idea that my work is all about the why to, not the how to.
Yeah. No, I think that's brilliant. I think that's good. That's something we should all take away, really.
Yeah. And that perfection is immaterial, you know, and in the materials too, you know. We don't live in a perfect world. an imperfection in what I find is what I want to celebrate.
Yeah. We have a little postcard up in our kitchen that Mary found somewhere, but I quite like it because it means the girls get to see it a lot. And it says, you're meant to be real, not meant to be perfect.
Absolutely. I think that's a great postcard. You'll have to send me a picture of that. Yeah, and remind definitely. Myself. Because I have to remind myself that with all these balls I'm still juggling in different ways, that you try to do the best you can, but that's all you can do because you are human and you're not perfect. And there is always some way you can move on. Did this become a talk about philosophy? I think
no, no, no. I love it. I love it. This always goes this way. Do you have a favourite album?
Do I have a favourite album? Don't know if I necessarily have a favourite album, but I am partial to the Kinks.
Uh-huh.
But I do have a favourite song. I have two. Am I allowed two?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Lark Ascending.
Oh, nice. Thomas Tallis and all that.
Yeah, Tom. Thomas Tallis.
No, it's Vaughan, isn't it?
Vaughan Williams.
Yeah.
Because he based a lot of his music on studying folk music.
Right.
Yeah. So Lark Ascending and Blackbird, Beatles.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah, so
good shouts. Blackbird, both bird related as well.
Pardon?
They're both bird related as well.
Yeah, I don't think that was necessarily it, but that, it's strange.
How do you feel about the funky
chicken? I just like the sentiment
in
that, but I'm kind of too eclectic in my music choice to have a singular album that I would always say that's my favourite album.
Do you listen to anything while you're working?
Sometimes. Less so now. It depends on what I'm doing. If I'm doing some art making, I might listen to music. Occasionally, I used to listen when I was stitching downstairs, less so now. Occasionally, I do, but depends on Derek's hearing, depending on how comfortable he is, because I want to sit with Derek sometimes, and too much disruption or distraction is hard for him to then focus. You need to focus on one thing at a time with the stroke. So if he's sometimes eating or moving, if I can't speak too much if he's walking in an area he's not familiar with, for example. So if we manage to go out for a tea or a coffee, get a taxi and go somewhere, he needs to walk concentrated because a distraction can mean a fall.
Yeah.
It has to be totally focused.
Yeah. Do you talk to your work while you're making it?
Yeah.
I feel like you might do,
Do you, Jamie? Do you?
Rarely do I do some work. Probably casually swearing when it starts to go a bit wrong.
I often do. It sounds like I'm a bit mad, but yeah.
I can see that because you've already said you're communicating with it through your fingers and stuff. I can imagine you talking to it as though it's, a person and, a being you're working with or whatever that makes sense.
Yeah, I like that. They are. I think that is in any artist's hands because you're kind of making something anew, aren't you? So even if there are from found materials, so... Yeah, you're
nurturing something into life, aren't you? Do you have a favourite film?
That is Kara's brain. You're probably able to tell
me. Don't worry.
It will come to me.
Do you want to do favourite book and then we can come back to favourite film? Might unlock it.
It might unlock it. It's a black and white. I think it is a black and white film. It's got Gregory Peck in defending a young black boy.
Not 12 Angry Men.
No.
What's the other one? To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes, that's it. To Kill a Mockingbird. Sorry.
What? No, you're
so
right.
Another bird.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's true. Wow.
There's something. Remember what I said at the beginning of this about those three bodies of work, which suddenly, yes, yeah. And
that's amazing.
Yeah. And the favourite film is The Colour Purple.
Okay. Sorry, is that the favourite book?
No, that's a second favourite, sorry.
Okay.
The Colour Purple.
Right.
And a favourite book sounds really strange, but it'll always be close to my heart because the first novel I read, and it's still there, is Black Beauty.
Okay.
Yeah?
Right. Not Blackbird Beauty.
No, just Black Beauty. But I read I read all the time, so I could have hundreds in that list.
I mean, do you like fiction?
I do like. I also like biographies. I read fiction for leisure, so I like Hundreds and Thousands and Claywick, which are by a Canadian painter. I'll have to fetch the book to get her name. Emily Carr. She's a Canadian painter, so I love Hundreds and Thousands and Claywick, yeah.
Okay. And then my last question is, what's the most interesting thing that nobody knows about you?
Well, how can I say what's interesting? What's the most, because I'm probably too exposed.
Yeah.
What's the most interesting thing that nobody knows about me? Because even though they've now discovered that I find gardening therapeutic because it's the sure physical aspect of it.
I mean, you might have lain your soul out so much. So you're, because the thing is you're at this point of uncertainty. You're at the creative edge all the time. So you're overexposed, you might say, because you don't get the chance to hide stuff away when you're playing in that ballpark.
No, and probably I choose not to, because maybe it's about that communication that I'm just like everybody else. I don't share everything, but you know, I had to think twice about how much I shared about what Derek was going through, or you know, so I don't post photos or things overly post what's happening here, but I do talk about it because I think that's giving voice to a lot of other stroke survivors and carers. So again, that connects to me having a voice and using it wisely. So
there's a balance to be found, I think, between talking about stuff and then glamorizing stuff. I mean, social media makes it difficult to talk about things that are meaningful and find that point where you're not showing off about it. Do you know, like so many people do, like virtue signaling and that kind of thing. It's quite hard to be sincere in the right kind of way because Facebook just amplifies all things in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and that can also be taken away from you anyway through Facebook and overshare, you know.
Yeah.
I think. I suppose that the one thing that probably a lot of people may or may not know that I have restricted vision.
Oh.
Did you not know that?
No, that's interesting.
I'm blind, virtually blind in my left eye, lazy eye, and I have a narrow field of view. So I literally, nobody can see this because this is not, you're not going to see, but that point, I'm looking at you at the moment, Jamie, and I can't see my hand moving there.
Oh, wow. Because you said that some people have got a third eye. You said you rely on your second eye a bit. And I was like, what? But that's what you're talking about there, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And my right eye, although I can see detail and see quite far, I don't have a wide field of view. So as soon as I move my hands, that says that my both of my hands looking straight at you are now out of my eyesight.
Right.
You can't see them because I'm off the screen there, aren't I? Yeah. In the little box. But more or less, that little box is my eyesight view.
So it's also surprisingly easy to creep up behind you and say, boo.
Yeah, that's the one thing, and people do. In fact, that probably is. When I'm in art class, I actually warn my students, if I'm carrying a drawing board or you're carrying a drawing board, don't come behind me. But yeah, that probably is. People could easily, and when we were out walking, it was always Derek who used to, on that side, would suddenly put his arm in front of me because I wouldn't have seen a car coming. So I now have to be doubly careful because I'm now his eyes when he's out. I always stand on his left, so my right is on his left, so I've still got a blind left because that's the side he's weak on and he can't see from when we're out. So that's where people could walk into him because people tend not to, you know, kiddies playing, families chatting, people looking at their mobile phone while they're walking are not aware of other people on the on the pavement. So I'm mindful of that so he doesn't get knocked because he wants to walk when he can.
Yeah.
So that may be the one thing that, I have restricted vision and it's easy to come up and boom. And people don't necessarily do it, but I do jump quite frequently. And when I'm in a working situation, I will jump quite frequently if somebody suddenly comes up behind me quietly because I'm not aware they're there.
It's fascinating because you've got restricted vision, but seemingly unrestricted creative vision.
Oh, that's
there you go.
Nice thing. Maybe I have. There are always restrictions. We always set restrictions. If I had unrestricted, I'd be working in all mediums, maybe.
No. But I love it because it's been really interesting because you, like you say, there's this uncertainty field, the edge of creativity and stuff. And you've been in that space for a long time that you're quite hardy to it. And yet it's still quite exciting. And I think that's what makes it fun. Because the minute we start getting a bit numb to those things, that's when we need to change it up. But it seems like you found some secret sauce.
I think a popular word in today's culture is the term resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And I, my life has always been about movement and change because that's the way of, I think it's the life of most artists. You're not in a job that's got steady income. You're not necessarily going to the same place of work each day. You know, you're striving, you're exhibiting, you're working all over the place. And I think that's what makes many artists, not just me, who we are today, and creative people and musicians, anybody who are actually using their skills to work independently and creatively, become incredibly flexible in the way I believe that fundamentally. And I think it's an incredible value to pass on to the next generation. Oh, God, we're going back to philosophy and moral well-being.
Can't get away from it.
No, I suppose I've lived that in my life. So that's how I've thought and worked. It's part imbued into the way I work.
That's amazing. Well, listen, Kaz, thanks for your time. So if people want to find you online, where's the best place to go?
I have a website, which is simply kazholmes.co.uk. And I have Google and Facebook, all the usual places. But maybe do a trawl because you might be surprised where you find me. I sometimes am when I do decide I'm going to do a trawl and things that maybe are slightly untrue.
There's a brilliant interview with you on the Textile Artist website as well. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. I enjoyed that interview. That was a good interview. But yeah.
Second best interview you've ever had, I heard.
Oh, right. This is going to be the first, is it, Jane?
We'll have to see. Listen, it's been a total pleasure. So thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
And thank you for inviting me. I'll get your needles out and keep stitching. Don't give up on your stitching, Jamie.
Perfect. Thanks for joining me on another needle exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange. That's needle.exchange with any thoughts, comments, or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange. That's needle.exchange with any thoughts, comments, or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.